All right, well, welcome. This is, I guess, day two. I hope everybody had a good night, got a good night's rest. Monday is typically a long day. I want to remind everyone to get the posters put up if you haven't put up your posters. If you didn't submit an abstract and still have a poster, I think we can probably arrange to get it put up. So the poster session will be in the lab side this afternoon. I don't have any other announcements. Does anyone else have announcements? All right, I'll turn it over to David.
Well, I'd like to thank Bridget and Clint and Ron for putting this on. People always say I'd like to do it, and then they never do it. So thank you very much for putting this on. Today's topic has to do with specimen preparation. And I assume we will have a very lively discussion, since whatever your level of expertise is, you all have to deal with specimens. So you should feel free, if you want, to interrupt the speaker to ask a question, or you could wait till the end if you want, but you shouldn't be afraid to ask questions. It's very important, especially from people who are just beginning. So I want to encourage people to do that. Specimen preparation, I think, of all the things we've heard, of all the marvelous advances and so on and so forth, what seems to really hold people back now is not so much the instrumentational. That's still is clearly very important, but oftentimes projects hang because the specimen isn't right. So the question I have for you is your specimen ready for this or instead of this? So we have assembled a superb panel of people. Tom Valtz will be speaking about challenges remaining for specimen preparation. Laurie Passmore about new kinds of substrates. Clint Potter, for you pronounce spotaton. Is that how it's pronounced? Spotaton. It means what it says. And Typhon, which I assume is some kind of whirlwind application of the sample. I don't know, he'll tell us. Single cell imaging with Henning Stahlberg and Elizabeth Villa for fib milling, or as we call it, fibbing. Anyway, it gives me great pleasure to introduce a truly wonderful speaker. I can't help but tease him. Tom Valtz.
Expect nothing else from you. Can I take out your memory stick, please?
What do you want, John?
I took out David's memory stick.
Oh.
Oh,
you need a memory stick?
No. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so I also want to start by thanking Clint, Bridget, and Ron for putting up this workshop. It's really always a pleasure to be here, and it's one of the few things that I never say no to, although I always know they try to give me something new to talk about. And what was making this event always so magical, at least to me, was that it was a very cramped room. Everybody was sitting on each other's laps. The speaker was basically right in the first front row. You were never able to see the slides anywhere beyond the top half. But it was really great because it really introduced a lot of discussion. And so now this is a much nicer room, but it's also much more formal. And so we should get back to spirit that they actually discuss rather than listening to talks. And so I put some specific friends in the audience which are going to try to heckle me to try and actually get some discussion going. So the more obnoxious and the more annoying the questions, the happier I will be. Shut up. So the topic I got this time was to look at challenges remaining for specimen preparation. And everybody else is going to talk about cool new stuff, and I have to talk about the things that we really haven't made any progress in, almost. And so, so all of us do electron microscopy, so we know the typical workflow. We start with protein, we make a grid, then we take images, we do all the image processing, and we end up with a 3D model. And so in EM imaging, obviously data collection has made tremendous progress with these DDD cameras. I've never been very impressed with technology, but I'm absolutely in love with these DDD cameras, and the K2 in particular. They're just amazing. And then also there has been a lot of process being made with the data processing. Maximum likelihood has become really powerful. 3D classifications and other, as Yvonne already said, these are really things that make a massive difference in how we can look at our specimen. So if we do all this correctly, we end up with a near-atomic resolution map. You see viruses, ribosomal complexes, CYP-V channel from Yvonne and gamma secretase. So it's no problem. Now we can do a near-atomic resolution. Well, the fact is it's not true. And the reason that we can't really do this is because we have to deal with proteins, and proteins are evil. So in a way, specimen preparation is considered to make good grids, but for me, specimen preparation really starts with the preparation of the protein itself. Most of what my group is doing is basically molecular biology and biochemistry, trying to get the specimen to the level where we can actually do good EM. And so the topic I have today, I do a little bit broader, so how do we get good protein and how do we make good grids? So there are two parts to my talk. And the question is, do we have in specimen preparation something as great and nice as a DDD camera or maximum likelihood? And the answer is no, and so that's the end of my talk. But Bridget gave me 75 minutes to talk about, so I have a lot of filling material. So that's, I can always skip about over some of the slides. You have the slides, so you can read it up. It's kind of self-explanatory. So it's more interesting if we can start discussing why things are actually going wrong. And Yvonne made a good point in the first day, which I wasn't aware of, which is eye thickness, that this is related to the resolution that you can get. I did not expect that, I have to say. All right, then. So why do we need to prepare specimens? So you can see I start filling time. And the reason is that biological specimens are very, very high in water content. So if you take a specimen, you put it into a microscope, you get complete dehydration of your specimen, you get a collapse of the structure, and then you don't look at anything interesting anymore. So we have to prepare the specimen to actually preserve it in the vacuum of the microscope. There are two typical ways to do this, stain embedding, where you put your protein into a layer of heavy metals, which doesn't do a great job in preserving a specimen, but it does do a little bit. Yes, Nico. Yeah. So actually, I don't know, but I tried to do it with 2D crystals. And the idea was if you get actually freeze drying going, that you just dry enough of the water that there's no structural water so that the structure doesn't collapse, you could actually try to do that. And you need special equipment for that. So you would need something that ETH Zurich has for metal shadowing, where you can actually see how the water disappears, and you know when you have to stop the drying, and then you can go and do put in the microscope. And I decided I don't want to do this. Bob.
Jacques Dubuchet looked at catalase crystals, frozen hydrated, and freeze-dried.
Okay.
And there is crystalline order preserved, but it's much, much poorer after freeze-drying. So Eddie Kellenberger kind of, I think, understood this, that when it's freeze-dried, there's still a lot of Brownian motion going on, and the structure collapses on itself, even though it's freeze-drying.
But you do freeze-drying, and then you cool it down, or you don't?
I think freeze-drying was done in the vacuum, because
yeah.
If you freeze-dry and then rehydrate, that really flattens things.
Yeah, that's terrible. But if you can freeze-dry it, you get rid of all the water, except the structural water that you need to preserve the structure, and then you freeze it down and put it in the microscope. I don't understand why you should have more Brownian motion.
No, the hydrophobic force is now gone when it's freeze-dried. And so you can have, you still have always have vibration and rotation and so forth.
Okay. So the idea...
I think empirically it's true that freeze-dried protein crystals do not diffract nearly as well as frozen hydrogen.
Yeah, but there should be a big difference between protein crystals versus
single molecule.
Isolated molecules, yeah, right? Because of the, you know, preserving the crystal lattice, which is also a lot of second and third shell layers and not just the primary hydration layer.
Yeah.
Right. So
so do you think it's a useful idea to try and follow up on?
I was you know, thinking very much along these lines too, that it seems that, you know, we lose so much in contrast by having all this solvent matching, and if we could, you know, get rid of most of it, you know, down to sort of the 20% or 25%, you know, hydration layer, you know, you would think that would be a potentially very good thing. And some of the mass spec approaches can do that,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that, you know, they can desolvate the bulk water, but be left with sort of the tightly bound layer.
Yeah, I've tried that in the microscope using the Gatan holder. You can very slowly increase the temperature. You have the controller there. So if you do it very gently, and I've done this maybe only on viruses just as a trial, you don't see at first approximation any difference. You only see the vast increase in contrast due to the lack of surrounding water. But my guess is if something changes with such gentle drying, it would be only the surface. If there are some flexible chains sticking out or something, then the water molecules from those may go away, but most of the water should kind of a monolayer or two layers of water should still remain on top of the structure and preserve the, especially the internal water should be still.
Has anybody actually done some serious experiments on this, on freeze drying?
I think I've done it by accident. You know, there's this phenomenon that when you try to make thin ice and you make it really, really thin, somehow the contrast goes way up. And I'm wondering, is that then a situation where we're getting freeze drying off of the protein surface? And anyway, all I know is that those very high contrast particles are no good.
Ottensmeier.
Yeah. Wasn't there a paper on instrument
receptor? He always freeze-dried his samples because he was doing scanning dark field microscopy. And he had no contrast unless they were dried.
Yeah, but I don't think he did a very good job at freeze-drying it just right.
Yeah. No, he did them in the microscope to gradually evaporate.
We're done.
Okay, but then. So.
Anybody else want to speak?
So for the young ones in the audience, that's a good topic. Try to freeze dry your samples, see what you get. That wasn't a joke. In any case, so we have a lot of problems with the water content of the samples. Another problem is that we have very light atoms, so we don't get a lot of inherent scattering of the specimen. So we prepare the specimen again, either by negative staining so that we have heavy metals to boost the contrast, or if we... So when we vitrify, we can artificially also improve the contrast either by high defocus. These days, you can take movies, take long exposures, you can use face plates. So this has really made it much better to work with vitrified specimens. And also because we have light atoms, we have to deal with beam damage. So for biological specimens, probably for each useful elastic scattering event, you have to deal with two inelastic damaging scattering events. So that makes it difficult, so we try to use very few electrons, but again, this has changed. Everything has changed in the last 2 years. And so now we don't have to do short exposures anymore. We can do long exposures and then just not use all the frames. When we collect movies, and we use low temperature, not to prevent the beam damage, but to prevent the effects of the beam damage. So you break your bonds, you get fragments, but because it's low temperature, they don't diffuse away, and so you get your beam damage, but you don't see it. And so the bottom line of all this is that you have two methods. You have negative staining, which limits your resolution, but it gives you somewhat better signal-to-noise ratio. And you can use vitrified specimens, which don't limit your resolution, but you have a really crappy signal-to-noise ratio. So that's the whole story of the whole thing. That's why we have to prepare our specimens. So now, two parts. One is how we prepare good grids, and then the second part is how we get the protein. So, again, it's very basic, so if you have questions, ask. We start with a grid, which is usually made of copper, gold, or molybdenum, and there are now newer materials, and I think Laurie is going to briefly mention these newer materials. And then we put a carbon film onto the grid, which can be either continuous carbon film or wholly carbon film, and again, there are now new substrates. Again, Laurie will talk about this. And then once we have our carbon film on the grid, we glow discharge it just to basically make it hydrophilic. Usually we get negative charge, but we can also put in amylamine, so you get positive charge. And then you put your specimen onto the carbon grid, which we usually do with a pipettman, but there's now this new technique that Clint is going to talk about, which is called spotted-on. And then once we have the specimen on the grid, now we can prepare it either by negative staining or by ice embedding or vitrification. So because I have 75 minutes, I'm going to talk about negative staining. We start with adsorbing the specimen on a usually continuous carbon film. And this is a review that we wrote, which is not obviously the first one, but it gives you a lot of practical advice how to do negative staining. And then once we have the specimen on the grid, we exchange the buffer solution by heavy metal solution, and then we simply dry it. And what we end up with is our specimen embedded in a layer of heavy metal salt crystals. There are different stains that you can use. There are the urinal stains, and then there's a bunch of other stains. The urinal formate and acetate stains are always criticized for being very low pH, while these stains down here, sodium silicon tungstate, ammonium molybdate, all these others, you can neutralize the stains. but the problem with these stains is that you get very low contrast, and you have a fairly high propensity to get radiation damage. So if you use these kind of stains, you probably have to do cryo-EM. I personally like urinal formate. It gives you a very good contrast. It gives you a finer grain than urinal acetate. It's less stable than urinal acetate, so you have to make it fresh all the time. But if you have an EM lab, you do a lot of EM, so it's not a big deal to make fresh urinal formate all the time. And as I said, the problem is it's an acidic stain. The pH is about 4.
So, I mean, can you freeze the urinal formate? And if so, at what temperature?
Can I go a little bit further and then we talk about this?
Okay, I have a question.
Oh, God. Be careful what you wish for.
So the question is this. You have all these stains. Has anyone done a comparison to see whether the structural information is better with one stain than another? So that's part one. And I have... It's a two-parter, Tom. The other thing I hear is complaints from people that when they send in a structure that was done with negative stain, referees reject it. And I would like to stick up for negative stain.
Thank you.
Yes, I think it's still valuable, but maybe there are people who have examples where there really is a discrepancy. I haven't heard of one, but there must be some.
I have one.
And the other thing is, it's right, it is a fixative, so sometimes it does better, especially in initial studies.
What was the second question?
Can we get the referees off our back? You, those of you out there.
Short answer, no.
No, but are some stains better?
Yeah, so that's all. So at the beginning, I really tried a lot. I tried all these different stains.
With the same specimen. Yeah.
And for me, all these stains here always gave a very poor contrast. And also, they're really beam sensitive. For example, orothioglucose, you put a little bit of dose on it and you start getting blisters. And so it's kind of painful, and it takes away the positive thing about negative stain, which is that it's very simple and quick. So in my opinion, or in my experience, we always get the best results with urinalformate, always. I don't know why, but it's just the case. Urinal acetate is similar, but formate is a nicer stain, in my opinion. And so let's do your question. What was your question?
You said you were going to get to it later. I mean, in a sense, can you If it's unstable, but can you freeze it?
Yeah, you can. Which one? The stain itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we never tried that. Probably can, but it's really not a big deal. If you have a lab that does EM, every few days somebody makes stain, it's really not a big deal. I don't know whether you can freeze and what would happen if you thaw it. Has anybody tried freezing your phone? Not a bad idea, I have to say. Don't tell my post.
We keep it
mundane. Okay.
And you have to make it quickly. I mean, if you're making it for a whole year, it'll start participating out within a half hour. You must make it very, very quickly out super fast.
The team effort.
The pipetting part.
Any bacteria growing in it? Anyway. So.
Done this for a long time, but I know that when I was learning how to do negative stains, each of the stains, there's a particular protocol and how you should be using it to get the best stain. Why is it so, or is there a table or something that somebody can tell a newcomer what they are supposed to do?
That's actually a really good question. So when I started my group, I had my protocol, which I wanted people do it this way, this works. And then you don't do it so much anymore, postdocs change, and suddenly the protocol that is used in my lab is totally different from what I actually thought they were doing. And they got good results, and so it's actually, I start with the standard protocol that I use, which isn't this one, but then sometimes, so we wash with water first before we stain. Some proteins don't like being washed with water, so you wash with buffer, for example. We usually do 2 drops of stain. The first one just exchange the buffer, the water with the stain, and then the second one to really stain. Some people just use 1 drop of stain. So it's kind of, you try and see what works best for you. Our protocol usually works, so we just use this one, I think. I'm not sure what the postdocs do. But it's usually not a huge difference. It's just if you protein.
Okay, I'm going to stir up this discussion a bit. So, David, I'm not that review, but I'm just going to tell you our experience. We're ever using less negative stain now because sometimes it is the stain itself gives problems and. You can't really average your particles really nicely, so negative stain class averages very often don't look that good. It's a lot of work to then optimize stain and get that working.
No.
Whereas we move quicker to ice now in our projects, because that you have to optimize anyway. And then we judge our protein quality.
So I give you
a 50
kilodalton protein, do an ice reconstruction for me.
This is not for 50 kilodalton, but it works for 150 kilodaltons. Hmm? Not for 50 kilodaltons, but for 150, we've just observed that people kind of skip the whole optimization.
And I bet you will not be able to make a 3D reconstruction. I agree with
challenge
you.
Accepted.
If you ever can, you do ice. You never, ever do something else, if you can. But there's so many proteins that are either too thin, too small, too flexible, where you just don't go anywhere. I show you an example where we have a 650 kilodalton protein, which we couldn't do anything, not even in stain. But, so yes, I agree, whenever you can, do vitrified ice, but be open-minded. Sometimes you just cannot do it. And then it's better to get some information than get no information. That's my opinion.
I just like to make a couple of comments. So I work with microtubules and microtubule binding proteins, and I just found that urinal formate does not preserve microtubules very well, so I have to use urinal acetate. And also for checking, as you were saying, to find if proteins bind, you can go through a lot of different experiments using the negative stain. Sometimes when you go to ice, they don't bind anymore. So I think the stain is good for finding out what really, it does fix things. So I think it's good for initial observations. But you have to be careful about whether you choose urinal formate or urinal acetate, because I think urinal formate doesn't always preserve as well.
So, no.
Can I suggest you have 80 more slides?
I can skip, don't worry. This is more interesting. But I am actually with David. This attitude against negative stain is really kind of annoying because we don't do it if we don't have to. We all love to do it in ice, but no method is perfect. And the question is, do you rather have no information whatsoever, or do you have at least a little bit of information that you can start thinking about your molecule? So that's your decision.
I have a small comment. I'm definitely not against negative stain. I use it often and sometimes successfully. But just a cautionary word for any of you who use detergents in your preps that can cause severe artifacts. And
what kinds of cause?
Detergents.
So
if you have to use detergent...
That's one of the things where we modify the preparation. So we go first over 10 drops of buffer before we start to stain, so we try to remove.
In our experience, even if in some detergents, for example, tween, even if you wash it out really, really well, you still get a lot of artifacts. And in fact, in our lab, it's a very famous story that the entire lab fell prey to an artifact of a tween micelle that everybody thought was actually a protein complex.
Yeah, and so I actually agree with that statement. So there are these very nice new detergents, LMG and all this, the X-ray crystallographers are really excited about. So we tried them, and they give horrible stain. You just get big balls and nothing else. But then if you have a little bit of experience, you know that this is not a protein, that is just nonsense. So for everything, you need a little bit of experience. So I'm thinking I'm going to...
Charles was saying that they cannot get good classifications, but they said it's not no problem. We have some public data. No, we have public data sets for cryo data, but it doesn't seem to me that there are any of the data sets that's available for people to try out different things. For negative stain, maybe it's a time to have a few really good ones.
Yeah, we have plenty of negative stain data sets. And in terms of classification, we are actually doing very well with ISAC now, because ISAC can really look at small differences. So with ISAC, we now get really nice classifications, and we can show you. Okay, moving on. Stain embedding is a second thing that you should look at. You can either do thin embedding or you can do thick embedding. Thin embedding is actually very good if you want to look at your specimen just in 2D. So this is one sample that we looked at. This is a filament, doesn't matter what it is. But in thin embedding, you can see that you get the stain layer left and right, and you get a lot of detail, so you can very easily see what you have. But this is really just good to have a look at it and maybe to do 2D classification. If you do thick embedding, it looks much worse, but it's actually much better to do thick embedding to calculate a 3D reconstruction. And so if you would do 3D reconstructions and negative stain, you would want to have a thick embedding, especially if you want to do random conical tilt rather than a common line approach. So the advantages of negative stain, there are advantages. It's very easy, it's very quick, you get good contrast, and it produces preferred orientations. In my book, this is an advantage. The drawbacks is that you limit your resolution to about 20 angstroms. We all know that it can introduce a lot of artifacts. You get incomplete stain embedding, you get adsorption deformation, you get especially specimen flattening. And this is when you do tilts, that's what you see. If you do reconstructions by common line approaches, you're actually not going to see the flattening. And another drawback is that it induces preferred orientations. And you might have noticed that you get the preferred orientations as a pro and as a con. And that's something in EM. It always depends what you want to get out of it, whether something is actually a good thing or a bad thing. If you want to do a 3D reconstruction, preferred orientation is not very good because you need different views. However, if you just want to use negative staining to see whether you have a homogeneous specimen, it's actually very good to have preferred orientations, because if the particles look different and they have the same orientation, you know immediately that you have some conformational or compositional heterogeneity. So for specimen checking, I think preferred orientations are actually very, very good. So there has been a lot of complaints about negative staining. And so people came up with different ways to do it. The first one was from Dubochet's lab. Mark Adrian did this, where he took your specimen, you put it into a holocarbon film, and you just put it into a high concentration, saturating concentration of ammonium molybdate. You then blot it, and you freeze it very quickly. And so this is kind of vitrified ice, except that you have a heavy metal solution, which gives you a lot of contrast, so this is good for small molecules. So the advantages are the same as before. You have good contrast. This time, the good thing is you actually get random orientation, so you could calculate 3D reconstruction. And because the freezing prevents specimen flattening, you don't absorb, so you get much less preparation artifacts. The drawback is that it limits the resolution still to about 20 angstrom. It induces now random conical, random orientations, randomly distributed orientations, I should say. And so this is not so good if you want to check for heterogeneity. So this is much more of a really a structure determination technique. And a major problem is that you have to have high concentration of your stain. So what it means is that the high ionic strength of the stain can actually dissociate your complexes. So this is a very nice method, but it hasn't been used very much, I think. Has anybody ever used this method? How did it go? Yeah, he is in the back.
Yeah, he got a 7 ounce
or 10 or so. So one of the problems with this method would be that at low resolution you have negative contrast, negative stain, and at high resolution between two atoms there's vacuum, so you must have positive contrast. And there is somewhere a resolution inversion, and that's probably different on the outside of a protein than from the inside of a protein. So I think for this reason it will never go to very high resolution.
So I agree. I would never, if you stain, I would never go beyond trust any information beyond 20 angstrom.
So we use that on Rad51 decorated DNA filaments, and they are helical. And when we looked at this Adrian method with these filaments, we did not see a zigzag in projection, a sinusoidal zigzag as it should be, but we just saw lines in one direction, stripe, showing that only one side of the fibrils was stained and the other side was invisible. And my interpretation was that the samples usually swim on the surface of the stain layer like a cork on water.
Okay.
Yeah, so you have only half of the sample visible and stained.
Okay, so in any case, there are only two people who tried it. It's not a very common method. So another method to do cryonegative staining was developed by Holger Stork and Carlo. And this is a very nice method. I really liked it a lot. So you basically have a continuous carbon film. You put your specimen on the carbon film. Then you add some glycerol. Then you put a second carbon, then you stain it and you put a second carbon film on top of it. You dry it and you freeze it. So this is actually quite a nice method. It gives you good contrast. It induces preferred orientations, which I actually like a negative stain. And you get much less preparation artifacts because the glycerol actually cushions the protein, so you get less absorption artifacts. It minimizes the specimen flattening. It also functions as a cryoprotectant. The carbon sandwich is nice because you make sure that the protein is completely embedded. And because you freeze it, you prevent complete drying of the specimen, so the flattening is not happening. So I really like this method. The problem is that it still limits your resolution to 20 angstrom. If you want to do a 3D reconstruction, you have to do tilt pairs. And it's probably the most painful method I've ever come across. And Mel can attest to it. She spent months trying to do this. It's really, really painful. But if you get good specimens, you get a lot out of it. And just a quick example, so this is comparing conventional negative staining to cryonegative staining with the Holger Stork method. So this is a tilt pair, this is 0 degree, this is a tilted. And what you can see when you tilt is this typical stain cloud under your particle, which you get from the tilting. So this means your particle is not completely embedded. You get typically two projections for transferrin receptor complex, the face view and the top view. So in projection, it looks very nice. But if you now calculate random conical tilt reconstruction, you can see that the way it lies on the grid, you get very nice features, but perpendicular to it, you get a massive flattening. And while the receptor should be a butterfly shape, what you get in negative staining is just a single blob. So there's no question that negative staining is going to affect your structure. Now, this is the other way to do it, the cryo-negative staining way. This is 0 degree, this is 60 degree tilt, and if you compare this, you immediately see that you don't have these edges below your particle. So these particles are fully embedded. You have a much better embedding. And if you look at the projection, these actually look nicer than these, but these have more information in them. And if you calculate the 3D reconstruction, for example, for the face view, you can now see where this one is terribly flattened. Now you really get the nice butterfly shape of the particle. So I was very impressed with this method. I really liked it a lot. Unfortunately, it doesn't solve all the problems. If you look at the top view, you get a good view this direction, but perpendicular, you can still see that you get flattening. So it doesn't solve all the problems, even if you try very hard. And these days, because cryo has become so much easier, we actually don't bother anymore with cryo-negative staining. We really now do pretty much just cryo whenever we can. So cryo vitrification, everybody knows, you have a holy carbon film, you bring your molecules in, you dry the grid a little bit to try and trap the molecules in your ice layer, and then you freeze it very quickly so you get amorphosized. The advantage is obviously very near native conditions. The protein thing is still floating around in a native buffer solution. You have no limitation on resolution, and you always induce, not always, but typically you get randomly distributed orientations. But nothing is perfect. The problem with cryo is that you get very low contrast. You don't use heavy metals. You only have the contrast from the protein. It used to be not very reproducible, and it's still not terribly reproducible. It's obviously much more tedious than trying to do negative staining. And again, if you want to just check your protein, see whether it's heterogeneous or not, it's not a good method because you get all these different orientations, so you don't know if particles look different, is it a different orientation, is it a different structure. So, but no discussion. If you can vitrify a specimen, it's clearly the best method.
Hello.
Oh, God.
You said early on that you would low discharge your grid. But then here you show particles that go into the hole. So how does that work?
I open this up for discussion. You need some height of felicity so you can wet the grid, so you need at least some height of... But it's a good question. So if you blow the charge too much, all your protons are going to stick on the carbon and you get nothing in the holes. So it's a little bit tricky way to find the best glow discharge condition. So what is the experience of people?
We've had a few experiences where the complex would not stick together when glow discharging and would actually stay together when not glow discharging. The grids don't look as great. The ice thickness is very variable, but we get the complex, so it might. That's just an idea.
A very thin carbon film over the holes, and then glow discharge.
Yeah, we got back to that. Yeah. You never can use the same concentration. You have to go up in concentration because when you blot, you just physically remove a lot of your sample. So you have to go up unless you use other techniques like a thin carbon film, graphene, monolayer. But if you want to do just pure vitrification, you have to go up in concentration just because it's a different way that you prepare the specimen.
I found if you blot from the backside of the grid instead of the face, you know, if you're using a wholly C-flat grid, so I think the surfaces are different from the back and the front. If I blot from the back, I can almost use the same... Actually, most times I can use the same concentration as I use a negative stain, or at least not 10 times, but maybe twice as concentrated and sometimes equal. So I think it depends on how you blot and which side you blot your grid from.
Yeah, so we played around a little bit with one-sided blotting, but for us, the ice always gets too thick, so it's difficult for us to get
a lot longer.
Okay, we'll try.
So you sort of glossed over. You said you blot until you get the right thickness of ice. And we heard from Ifan yesterday that getting
back to that. This comes.
Okay.
Thank you. But no, it's a very good question. That's why I have a special slide for it.
Yeah, for some of our samples, we double blot, and we will blot from the back, but we double blot. So we blot, and then we blot again.
We come back to that as well. So let me maybe continue.
Yeah, I don't know if people have made that calculation, but I wonder if you know the concentration of your protein and then ask how much of, if that matches up with the concentration you end up seeing in the whole. My impression is you see, well, with some protein at least, you see more in the whole than you would expect to end up if you take that volume that ends up in the whole.
Really?
Well, so I wonder if
more or less?
In other words, I get 100 times less protein than you would expect.
That's what I would expect, yeah.
In other samples, it was only 10. So, always over. I never saw 5.
That makes sense to me.
Well, if there is evaporation, if your humidity is not good, for example, you can get more.
Got it. You have your
Yeah, evaporation could increase the concentration if you wait too long or your humidity is low in the chamber.
We get back to that as well. No, let's move on and then maybe I should get through some of my slides. Okay, so what is a good cryo-EM grid? And so what we would like is to have good amorphous ice. We don't want to have crystalline ice. We don't want to have leopard skin ice. We don't want to have contamination. So good ice, we want to have appropriate thickness, typically as thin as possible. Then we want to have clearly visible particles. If you don't see your particles, don't pick them. They're not there. And this depends. And this depends on the size and the shape of the particle. The molecular weight is not enough. The shape is also important. Buffer composition makes a difference how good you will see your particles. And now with the new technologies, you can use multifocus, you can take movies, and you can use phase plates. So there's a lot of technical stuff now we can do to actually increase the contrast of the particle shores.
Yeah, typically as thin as possible, I'd like to make it do that.
I'll come back to that. Okay. Okay, and then what we also want to have is good particle distribution. And the first thing, of course, we would actually like to have the particles in the holes, which is not always trivial. We want to have dense particles, but ideally not touching each other. And then we want to have randomly distributed orientations. That would be a good EM grid. That's what we aspire to. So how can we get this? So there are a bunch of variables that we can change when we vitrify. We can change the grid, the type of the grid, and the substrate. So Laurie is going to talk about this. You should be aware that the batch of the grid can be very different. If you get a condition for one batch of grid, you wait a few months, you get a different batch of grid, all the conditions can be completely different. It's really painful. And so also the age, which means either phobicity of the grid plays a role, and then glow discharging. So these are the parameters you can modify. Then the sample you can modify, obviously you can try to concentrate your sample, you can try different buffers, you can try to use amplipoles instead of detergents. So you can modify your sample. And then finally, the actual freezing, which is mostly the blotting and the drying. And so the initial blotting time physically removes the water. And so you remove everything, salts, water, sample, everything. And as you said, you can either do single blotting or double-side blotting. Then once you blot it, you can wait a little bit before you actually freeze your grid. And in this case, what you get is evaporation, which is not physical removal of the fluid. So you only remove the water, which will concentrate your specimen, but it would also concentrate everything else, salts, pH, everything changes. If you have a sensitive protein, that can cause a problem. So you have to see which one works better for you, whether you blot more or whether you dry more. And the drying can modify depending on the temperature and the humidity of the environmental chamber that you have. And then a very nice method is actually multiple applications of your specimen. So this is what we want to get. This is what we have to play around with. And so I thought I'd just talk about this and what we do to get this. So the first thing, we don't want to have crystalline ice. To avoid getting crystalline ice, what you have to do is you have to freeze the specimen very, very quickly. So the temperature has to decrease 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 Kelvin per second, very fast freezing. And what people introduce to do this are these plungers. This is an old plunger, which is one from Nigel Unwin's paper. And so what do we have to be aware of? So one of the things we need to know is that the sample itself, is that the water is actually a fairly bad thermal conductor. So if you want to get a fast freezing phase, you actually have to have fairly thin samples, so you get really freezing all the way to the core very quickly. The second thing we have to think about is the coolant, the wetting characteristics of the coolant. So we all know that liquid nitrogen is terrible because of the Leidenfrost effect. So if something touches liquid nitrogen, it vaporizes, you get a vapor film that actually insulates now your specimen, so you don't get much of a cooling. And so to avoid this, we all now use ethane, which we cool down by liquid nitrogen. So this is one thing. Then obviously the acceleration is very important. If you want to cool very quickly, we want to have a very quick acceleration that it goes right into it. And then something people haven't thought much about, we have never thought about it, it's actually the distance between the tip and the coolant is important. So when I started, I used to be an electrical crystallographer. It took me a long time to actually start to do Singapore EM. And so we got one of these instruments, and we never got good eyes. We just never got good eyes. And what we figured out eventually was that the forceps that we used was too long, so the distance between the grid and the coolant was too small. And so it didn't go in fast enough, and we never got good eyes. So that's painful. You learn from experience. And so if you get nice eyes, this is what it looks like. You have kind of a vitreous ice, and you can see nicely distributed particles. So that's what we like. This we don't like. This is crystalline ice. And I'm sure all of you have seen this. And also, you can get this in the same hole. You can have hexagonal ice, and you can have vitreous ice. So we have all seen this. So with the early plungers, these homemade plungers, it was actually kind of an art form. And so I was very lucky. I had Yifan in the lab, so we just gave Yifan everything to freeze. Most other people couldn't freeze. But now it's really nice because there are these semi-automated freezing machines, the FEI Vitrobot and the Catan Cryo Plunge. And with this, freezing has become much less of an art form. It's become much more doable for pretty much. So everybody in the lab can now freeze. So that's great. Now, the next thing I wanted to talk about is leopard skin ice. And that's something, yes?
So when I was in Boulder, we used the propane ethane mixture in our Vitrobot and got pretty reasonable ice across the whole grid. And now I work in Rocky Mountain Labs in Montana. We also use the same exact Vitrobot, ethane only, but we have the K2 grid system. And I noticed that squares that it's cubic ice or hexagonal ice, half or not, or this one will have it, this one won't, this one will have it, this one won't. Is that pretty normal? I don't remember seeing this very often in Boulder, and I don't know if it's the
ethane propane mix or if it's having the K2 ring around it or what's causing this massive change of ice across the grid.
Very good question. No answer. We have it. For us, it's very typical that we have good ice and bad ice on the same grid all the time. So people have ideas. How can you improve the ratio of good holes versus bad holes?
So by the K2, you mean the overgrid of the Titan?
Yeah.
I
didn't say that. I meant the
Krios
when I said that.
Yeah, so maybe because there is a kind of a ring around the grid, it can slow down the process of ethane touching the grid when it's plunged, some kind of hydrodynamic effect. I don't know. I have no experience with those. We always plunge naked grid, and then we clip them into the auto grids.
Okay, so we don't have a cryos, so that's actually interesting to me. Cryos users, do you see this often, that you have this kind of mix between crystalline and amorphous ice on your grid with your cryos specimens?
Sounds like it's just you've got a larger mass that you're trying to cool down. So
Yes, I agree with this, but
so
could you figure this out, how you can change
it? We usually plot the grids first and then mount them into auto grids. And if you're careful, then they don't even break too much. I think this that some grid squares have crystalline ice and others not, could be if the ethane is not cold enough.
Always bring the ethane to the point of freezing when you see that there is a little bit of frozen ethane in the cup. And then you unfreeze it gently and then you plunge. Yeah.
We switched to that mixture and we're very happy with you using that instead of pure ethane.
Like 2 to 1, right?
50, 50, 50. So you mix ethane and propane.
So we don't need a thermocouple in the vitroblot then. So we won't need a thermocouple in the vitroblot then, if we use your mixture. The thermocouple to keep the temperature even? Yeah.
Subtle, very subtle. Okay. So one of my frustrations is this thing called Laput-Skin ice. And so this is ice that we like. This is ice we don't like. And this is called Laput-Skin ice, and probably all of you have seen it. And so the question is, what is it? How does it happen? If we know what it is and how it happens, can we actually avoid it? And one question that I have and would actually like to ask you is, how bad is it? And there has been a major stream on 3DEM a while back, and there are these people who know exactly what it is. It's nano-ice salt crystals. They also tell you how to fix it. You freeze your sample in a different lab. And then there are people who are not so sure what it is and still discuss what it is. And what I learned, the most thing that I learned from this is actually that this is ice has many different names. So in Florida, it's called alligator ice. In Australia, it's called snake skin ice. And in Germany, it's called Schildkröten or turtle ice. That's what I took off this discussion, and I still don't know what it is. And so this is something I would really like to know. So obviously, it's not good. What you want is nice amorphous ice. But is this leopard skin ice, is there something on the surface of the ice, so it actually doesn't affect your protein very much, and because it's actually fairly large, it shouldn't really affect your alignment very much? Or is it something that is inside of the ice and can actually damage your protein, in which case you should obviously not use it? At the moment we are on the safe side, we should throw all these images away, but do we have to, or can we use this? Has anybody made some experiments about this? Does anybody know what it is? Sasha?
I have seen a lot of discussions and part of this also on the 3DM, and I can only speak for what we within FEI call leopard skin. It was a problem that was due to cooling, and it was just showing up for experiments that are 3 days or longer. So Cryos, the first Cryos users were concerned about that. I think we'd need to make a difference between that process, so the cooling over time. And in that sense, I would say it's a surface effect. And we have now one part of our system acceptance test where you can record images with a higher dose and over time, and you can show that it's a surface effect and it goes away.
So
as opposed to other phenomena where people are having problems right after insertion of the normal cryo holder on a TF20 type of microscope, on a side entry holder. So I would try to make a difference between the two processes.
So because we're starting to run a little bit late, maybe in the discussion section we can talk more about this, but this is something that I find interesting. Then we don't want to have contamination. Everybody has seen contamination. You have a little bit of ice, and you can get it a lot worse. So this is about the most that we accept. When it gets more than this, we throw away the image. Why do you get contamination? Usually during grid transfers. due to the humidity in the air. So what you want to try is to transfer your grids very quickly, and you try to use a low humidity environment, so you can either use a desiccator or you can go into a cold room. Another thing that can actually introduce contamination is your liquid nitrogen. So if your liquid nitrogen has water in it, you will also find contamination. So a good way to do it is you take these narrow nactules, which have very little exposure to the air, so you don't get as much water into the liquid nitrogen, and dry them out, try and minimize the water in your liquid nitrogen. Next, thin ice is usually better than thick ice. Yvonne gave us another reason why we like thin ice. But the principle why we like thin ice is very simple. The proton density is not much higher than just pure water density. And we never use pure water. We have salt, buffer, and so on. So the difference in contrast is not very big between your ice and your protein. So if you have thin ice and you have mostly protein or no protein, this is a big contrast difference. If you have thick ice, all this doesn't help you. It just reduces your contrast because only this little part is what gives you contrast. So it's a very simple reason why we like to have thin ice. And so especially for small proteins, and now we get into smaller and smaller proteins, we like to have thinner and thinner ice. Now, what affects eye thickness? The thickness of the carbon film, that's an unusual problem. Sometimes if you work with extremely large viruses, you can't make the ice thick enough. And in this case, you can just evaporate extra carbon onto the grid to make and try to make the ice thicker. But this is an unusual problem. The hydrophobicity of the carbon film, so you need to do a little bit. You need some hydrophilicity so you can spread the water on the grid. And then you can play around with glow discharging, what is better for you and what is not so good. The blotting, as I mentioned, the time of the blotting, how long you blot, physically remove the fluid, and then single or double-sided blotting. And so we tried single-sided blotting in a way, in an attempt to concentrate the specimen, but we always got too thick ice, so we just tried to blot much longer then, but we could never blot long enough that we got thin ice. So I need to talk to you and see how you do it. And then the waiting between you blot and you freeze, this is the evaporation phase. That can be controlled by time, temperature, and humidity. But as I said before, only the water evaporates, so you change the buffer, and if you have a sensitive protein, it can make a difference.
What about the volume of the sample that you load on the grid? Does that make a difference in the thickness?
Well, if you put more onto your grid, then you have to blot longer to get to the same thickness. You just have to change the blotting time.
Okay. And it doesn't, you haven't noticed a big
difference?
People
disagree with me, so who disagrees? So how? What
smaller
do you?
Volumes sometimes lend themselves having thicker ice because if you, by the way, if you look at the Leica machine, the newer Leica machine where you blot from one side and you can see with the microscope, with the optical microscope, how it goes on, you would learn many, many things about the behavior. And you see that the droplet is actually, there is a phase where the droplet just see the paper and then it jumps to the paper. Sometimes it's pulled the grid with it, and then you can see how it's tear apart from the liquid is tearing apart. So actually, when you have a small volume, sometimes this behavior doesn't happen, and then you end up with thicker ice. Also, the behavior is more random, because if you have this 2.52 microliter droplet in this case, you would see that time after time, especially if the grid is a little bit slanted.
So you would actually propose that if you have problems, try more and less and more volume to
yes.
And see what happens?
And you see the geometry of blotting. And it seems that it's not just a simple process of just transfer. There's something more complex going on. You are actually tearing the liquid out of the sample. And it's like you see how the droplet is peeled off the sample. It's not just that you transfer the liquid. It seems to me that the host never see the paper. They don't really touch.
And also the filter paper obviously plays an important role, which kind of filter paper you use. So,
Actually, my question was in that direction. So the filter paper or other substrates that you use for blotting. Are you going to elaborate on that?
Water, man, filled paper two, number two, right? So we didn't play around a lot. We just take the same filter paper all the time. And I think if you take different one, it can actually blot too fast, and you don't get nice eyes. Anybody played around with different filter papers? Olga.
We have at least tried to use nitrocellulose to blot, and that is way slower, so you have to blot much longer, so you have lower flow rates of your water removal, and that is, for some complexes,
I can't even hear you with the microphone. That's amazing.
You didn't hear me?
That's interesting. So nitrocellulose. Okay, we'll try that too. Okay. Onwards. And then why the thinner the better, that's a common rule. But sometimes thicker ice is actually better. Why? Sometimes you get your protein to attach to the air-water interface and you end up with these preferred orientations, which is not what you want if you want to calculate 3D reconstruction. So if you make thicker ice, you have less chance of the protein to actually touch the air-water interface and you get more random distributed orientations. If you have very gentle proteins, very labile proteins and complexes, if it touches the surface tension of the air-water interface, you can denature the protein, the complexes can dissociate. So in this case, you want to also make the ice thicker that you reduce the probability that the protein gets in touch with the air-water interface.
Tom, you are referring to this assuming that this is a static process.
It's a what?
So static process that actually you make the ice and the proteins are actually sitting there and waiting and not moving, but proteins are diffusing, and we are going typically, you know, 10 to the 5.
I agree with you. It doesn't convince me also.
Okay.
This convinces me a little less. So here you basically, what you do is you do chemical cross-linking, chemical fixation, to avoid this problem. Another issue is that the ice layer actually doesn't look like this. It actually has a meniscus. And so if you have big particles, often what you find is that you push your particles to the edges, especially viruses, very often you see along the rims, but not so much in the center of the grid. And this problem is more severe if you actually work with membrane proteins where you have detergent, because it lowers the surface tension, so you get much more of this. That's why it's harder to get good ice, good thin ice, with detergent, and that's why it might be good to try amphipoles also. And then to minimize the problem, if you really have a big problem, you can try to make the hole smaller so that you get less of this. Okay, factors that affect visibility of particles. So we want to see the particles. Again, if you don't see the particles, don't pick them. What is important is not only the molecular weight of the protein, it's also important the shape. So typically, you need a certain size so that you get enough scattering that you can see the proteins. Now with the movies, it's much better because we can just increase the number of frames that we record. And for particles of the same molecular weight, globule particles are typically easier to see than very extended molecules for obvious reasons. The ice thickness is important. As I said before, we try to minimize the ice thickness so we get the best possible contrast. And then also buffer composition. Again, the protein and water are not so different. If you have 100% glycerol, you have hardly any difference anymore. So if you have a lot of glycerol, sugar, salt, and detergent, it will all affect the visibility of your particles. So how to improve visibility, the evil word, negative staining. You can always use negative staining. You improve your contrast, but it comes with all the typical problems, limited resolution, deformations. But if you do it right, you can actually get very good information out of negative staining. Other ways to improve your contrast is high defocus. It limits the resolution. People who talk about imaging can explain you why. So this is one of my favorite things about the K2 cameras. You can just extend how many frames you take, and you basically can record until it starts bubbling and your eyes disappears. And then you can put all the frames into an image, you can do all your alignment, all your image processing with it, and then in the last step, you can either remove the last frames or you can weigh them. I think, Charles, you do this, right? And so you can basically get all the low information information as well as the useful high resolution information. So these movies are great.
Has anybody done quantification on the actual increase in the signal noise ratio for long movies between frames?
So the person who would have done this would be David or Yifan or Shores or Richard. Anybody?
I mean, we calculate beat actors for individual frames, and you see, there you get a much larger beat actors for the frames. So, yeah, so the weight leverage increases the signal-to-noise ratio. So if you weigh the correct, you can see that the signal-to-noise ratio of those images goes up.
Yeah, I just remember there was an old paper from the Occam's group on approximate signal noise ratios for some particles in ice.
So you can actually ask this question when Charles talks, so let's keep it specimen. But can we try to go to the end?
So we have experiments on viruses where we track essentially the SNR decrease with increasing dose. So we can actually describe quite well how the SNR is changing with increasing dose. So that's one. That's a poster, so you can come and talk to me about that if you want.
Okay, then obviously the new trick is phase plates, and you will see presentations from Rado and Vaughn about this. So the last point, not the last point, the second last, good particle distribution. So why are my lovely particles not in the nice holes? And how do I get there? And so one thing, of course, is you can try, your sample might be simply too dilute, and so you can try to increase the concentration. This doesn't always work. And then what you can do is you can use a thin carbon or graphene film or lipid monolayer to absorb your particles on this. Another possibility is that the protein complex prefers to stick to carbon film, which probably most of them will do. So what you can try is to change the grid batch. You can try to vary glow discharge conditions. Again, you can use a thin carbon film, a lipid monolayer, to absorb your particles. And something that worked very well for us is you can try to apply your specimen more than once. The first application will kind of saturate all your carbon film, and so these binding places go away. And then if you apply the specimen again, you have a better chance that it actually goes into the holes. And then if your ice is not thick enough that it cannot accommodate large particles, you can evaporate carbon onto the holy carbon film. And then if you have these protein or labile complexes that disintegrate when they touch the water interface, you can try chemical fixation. Or again, you can try to absorb it to a thin carbon film or to a lipid monolayer. I should say that whenever you use a carbon film or a lipid monolayer, it will reduce your contrast that you get in your images, obviously. Graphene is better because it's very electron transparent. So you will talk about this. And whenever you absorb a protein onto a carbon layer, you have a risk that you induce the photon inhalation. So nothing is perfect. So back to the effect of particle distribution, once you have it in your hole, you have sample concentration, it's not linear. Much particles, you can't just double the concentration. Somehow it doesn't work this way. The ice thickness is important. This one, it varies across the room, it's in many ways. And it's more problematic for samples that contain detergent because of the reduced surface tension. And that might be another advantage of using amphipose, that you can possibly make thinner ice, probably. Right, Yifan? Okay, I got approval. Buffer composition. If you have a protein that tends to aggregate, you can change the salt concentration, so you get different ionic interactions. You can add a little bit of detergent to try and separate aggregates. So, a different ways to do it. So, what's another problem that we encountered much more often than we like is that we actually get preferred orientations of our particles in the ice. So what we try is to do thicker ice. So this is one of the AAA ATPases. You will hear much more about AAA ATPases tonight. But this is one that we work with. and every single freaking particle shows you the same face. So it's hopeless to try and make a 3D reconstruction. So what we did was to make thicker eyes. Now we actually see these side views. These are double rings, so now you can see different views of your particle. The price you pay is that the top views are now much less obvious than if you have the thin eyes. But so everything in EM is a compromise between what you need and what you get. If this doesn't work, you can try to add some detergent. So this is another AAA TPAs we are working with. Again, everything is triangular. Everything shows you the same face. We tried thicker eyes. It didn't help. So this time, we tried to put in some detergent below CMC. This was actually then working. The particles look kind of nasty, but these are now actually different views. So this worked for this particular system. If this doesn't work, another strange counterintuitive thing is that you can actually try to use a carbon film. And this is an observation that Yifan made a long time ago when he was at Harvard, where we looked at transferrin receptor transferrin complex, when we picked the particles, and you look at the angular distribution, we have massive preferred orientation. If we now take the same sample and put it on a thin carbon film and look at the particle distribution, we get much more of a distribution. So why is that? Carbon should actually align it. And my explanation is that the alignment effect of the carbon is less extreme than the alignment effect of the air-water interface, so that sometimes you can actually get better results if you have a thin carbon film. If this doesn't work, you can try to change the buffer composition, you can try to change the glow discharging, you can try to tag the protein. That's something I heard from David and Yifan. If you have a protein that is tagged, try to cut off the tag. If you have a protein that doesn't have tags, put a tag on it. It can change the orientation, obviously. And if none of this works, bite the bullet, tilt the grid, enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. I don't know, why can tomographers do high tilts and we in single particles cannot? It's something I don't understand. In any case, if you do it, forget about high resolution. We tried this. This is an image of MTORC1 tilted 45 degrees. So this is olden times where we did it on film. You can see when you tilt, the contrast goes down dramatically just because the layer becomes thicker. And if you look at the averages, still most of the averages show you the same face, but sometimes you get something that might be a different view. So we were able to calculate a 3D reconstruction which had some features along this direction, but perpendicular you can see there's really no feature. It's just, and we could never fix it. We could never really get different orientations. So, oh God. That was the first half. So now assume you made the perfect grid. You get very high contrast particles that are perfectly distributed. They're all in the holes. They're randomly distributed orientation. You have the perfect, absolute perfect grid. Now you take the absolute perfect images, which means you have tone rings that go beyond the Nyquist frequency. So obviously you use the K2 camera here. And then you did the optimal image processing, which means these days you rely on and made it all the way to the publish button. So if you do all this, you are awarded with a really nice map. You look at it, and you get really worried because you don't see any side chains. Now, this is the big problem that we have. We can do everything the best we can, and it doesn't mean we get to really high resolution. And that's what Yifan also mentioned in the first day. Why not? And so one of the possibilities is that the protein is actually really important. You try to optimize your protein as much as you can. And so what is good protein for EM? The size is important. The bigger, the better. Currently, I think 250 kilovolts is smaller than people have gotten to near atomic resolution. Symmetry is important. The higher symmetry, the better. Pseudosymmetry is a bitch. That's what you not want. Shape is important. Globular is usually better than extended. And if you have any extra features that help your alignment orientation, that's very useful. And then finally, the big one is homogeneity. And the more homogeneous the sample is, the better it is for you. And now with the new DDD cameras, this amazing image quality, as well as with the new software tools like 3D classification, heterogeneity has become so much more manageable than before. It has become so much easier to do it. But still, the more homogeneous, the less problems you will live with. So the best case scenario is that you have large proteins that are globular, have high symmetry and little heterogeneity. And so let's just call it by name, viruses. If you look at viruses, you're almost guaranteed to get an atomic model these days. Now there's the opposite, which is the worst case scenario, that small protein extended, asymmetric, highly flexible, in other words, the samples that we work with. And so we have been condemned to negative stain for a long, long time. It's not fun, but Charles, I would love you to have some of our samples and see what you can do in ice. So a typical sample is somewhere in between. It's kind of a mixture of this. And the question is, what resolution are you going to get? And that's something we can discuss, because I'm kind of at a loss, because I used to be able, when I looked at the sample and the images, I could guess whether it's going to go to high resolution or not. Now, high resolution means near atomic resolution, and I no longer can guess whether a protein is actually going to go to near atomic resolution or is going to die at 6 or 8 angstrom. And so that's something we don't understand, and something we should probably discuss. Now, an obvious thing is that different characteristics can compensate for each other. So if you have a large molecule, you don't need very high symmetry. For example, the ribosome, you can get to near atomic resolution. If you have a large molecule, you can tolerate more heterogeneity. Again, the ribosome is a good example. If you have a small molecule, but you have high symmetry, for example, helical symmetry in filaments, you can actually also go to near atomic resolution. So it's just a combination of all the different characteristics that will decide how likely you are to go to high resolution. And so just to make a case that big and oligomeric is not always good enough for us, and that's a very painful slide to show. So Liang Tong had a student in his lab who came to do a postdoc in my group. And so he had this new protein, 120 kilodalton, which forms a hexamer. So it's 720 kilodalton. And so he approached us to do this. And I was ecstatic for the first time. High, big protein, symmetry, something we can go to high resolution. So we took the protein, put it into negative stain. We always put it into negative stain. And that's what we saw, a complete mess, total utter mess. So we calculated averages, and if we look at the averages, the peripheral densities go in all kinds of different directions. If you make a little movie out of it, it's like a little jellyfish. It's just hopeless. So it's big, it's symmetric, but it's not very good for us. And what made it so painful for us was that they got 3D crystals out of it and got an atomic structure by crystallography. So that's not something I expected quite readily. So one of the possibilities is what people mentioned. Maybe it's actually negative staining that introduces artificially this heterogeneity. Maybe it's actually much more homogeneous than ice. And so we spent a ridiculous amount of time taking images, optimizing imaging conditions, tried different software procedures. We never got any meaningful 3D reconstruction. So size and symmetry is not everything. Flexibility is a big issue. And what is nice about 3D crystals, why 3D crystals are actually great sometimes, is because they induce the proteins to adopt certain conformation, then they crystallize. And it's like a purification by crystallization. And I'm running out of time, and I'm over in my talk. What we learned from Yifan is that small is not what it used to be. So now we can work with much smaller molecules and go to very high resolution. So what do we do when we have a very nicely behaved protein, but it's still too small? Again, Yifan gave the solution. We use FABs. And this is really amazing to me. This is a dimer, which is 65 kilodaltons. Nobody would have ever thought to put this into ice. But if you add two FABs, suddenly it's big enough that you can actually get it almost to sub-nanometer resolution. It's a great technique because it not only increases the size of the particle, but it also adds an additional feature that helps you in the alignment process. So that's actually a very nice benefit. And then you have this inherent quality control. If your fab looks like a fab, then probably your density map is correct. The problem is that usually you want the fab not to affect the protein function. Usually, sometimes it's actually useful to have a fab that locks your protein into a certain conformation. You should have tight binding, so you should have a low off rate. And it should not introduce structural variability. So if your fab binds to a flexible loop, you create more problems than you create a solution. Symmetry, always helpful. Again, viruses are a very nice example. They usually go to high resolution. And this is an example from Dico's lab where he had the icosahedral symmetry, but then he had an additional 13-fold non-icosahedral symmetry. And so you can see how nicely actually the map further improves by additional averaging. So symmetry is always good. Pseudosymmetry is bad. The problem that it has depends on different things. It depends on how the degree of deviation from the symmetry. If it's just a small symmetry, it's going to be difficult to spot. If it's a lot of deviation, it's easier to spot. If it's a big molecule, it's easier to see whether you have good true or false symmetry, and obviously the resolution of the map. We have run into this quite a few times now. Triple H cases all seem to have no symmetry. And something that is really remarkably helpful is Rosetta with Frank DiMaio, and I'm actually really looking forward to his talk. This stuff has become extremely powerful. Now, if you can't use computation to figure out whether you have true symmetry or non-true symmetry, if you know that you have pseudosymmetry, again, FAPS is a good method to actually put a FAP to one of your proteins and you artificially introduce more symmetry so that you can now align and you know exactly which side is which. Protein shape, let's go over this. You have the slides. So the important thing is protein biochemistry, the universal principle, junk in, junk out. What means that in the end, you put junky protein in, you will get a junky map out. So you can do as much, as good as you want with all this. If this is crap, this will be crap. So it's good time investment to try and optimize the protein purification. This is my slide of platitudes. So no sample is ever going to be homogeneous. You will always have some kind of heterogeneity. It's just a question of how much heterogeneity it is. And once you have optimized your sample, the rest has become much more easy than it used to be. So once you have good protein, imaging and image reconstruction has become much easier. How do you check quality? SDS page is somewhat informative. A gel filtration peak is very nice. But an image is worth more than 1,000 words. So once, I never commit to a collaboration before I've seen a negative stain image. Why? Because negative stain actually gives you much more information, so you can read this up on your slides. But I believe that negative staining gives you much more information than any gel or any gel filtration profile. But there are also problems. Carbon film can induce artificial heterogeneity, different shapes observed in negative stain EM doesn't always mean that you have heterogeneity. You might also have different orientations, so that needs a little bit of expertise and experience. And then for the X-ray crystallographers, even if we see heterogeneity in the microscope, as you have seen from Yang Tong's sample, you might still be able to crystallize it because the crystal lattice actually induces some more homogeneity than what you have in solution. Okay, so compositional homogeneity, chemical fixation. So let me go through this very quickly. You can fix it with glutaldehyde. We can do it just in solution. You check an SDS page. Holger has introduced this very nice method, graphic, where you actually fix it over a gradient, massive improvement. Jorgis Gignotis has recently introduced a new method where you actually now can cross-link your specimen as you run it over gel filtration column, also a very nice method. This is before cross-linking, this is after cross-linking, and that's an important point. Cross-linking will make it easier for you because you get more homogeneous sample, but you're going to lose some of the heterogeneity, and this heterogeneity actually contains a lot of information. If you cross-link, always also look at the protein without cross-linking and see what you lose and what you gain. Other optimizing sample buffer, this has become more interesting. There is this new way that Holger is working with, which is called thermofluor-based high-throughput stability optimization. And Holger has presented this 2 years ago. I've been looking in the literature. I'm always looking for this. So any news on this? Okay, it's going to come out, hopefully. Okay. This is very powerful. So methods that will make an impact, cross-linking is good, buffer optimization is very useful. Just for completion, other methods have been tried, blotting from native gels. We have tried it, we usually find it very difficult to get enough proteins onto the grid that we can do something with it. We also tried affinity grids. This is an example that worked for York and Frank, where you can actually see the ligand. We have given up on the affinity grid. So I think cross-linking and buff optimization are very promising. Conformation homogeneity, we usually use negative stain always to assess the homogeneity of a protein, not necessarily for the structure determination, but just to see whether we have heterogeneity. The reason negative stain is good for this is because you have high contrast and preferred orientation, so it's very quick and easy to see do you have the same shape, you have different shapes. If you have conformation heterogeneity, it's usually difficult to manage. You can try to add substrate, cofactors, ligands, anything that brings your protein into a specific functional state. You can try to modify the buffer. You can try chemical cross-linking. And for membrane proteins, you can try amplipoles. So there are different ways you can try to do that. But as I said before, heterogeneity became much more manageable due to better image quality and better software tools. So in my lab, when people see heterogeneity, they get very distressed because it almost always is going to give you high resolution. My reaction is always different. I'm always very happy because different conformations are actually interesting. That's what proteins do. So you want to see that. This is going to make a much more interesting story than a high resolution. But then, of course, we do this low resolution stuff. We submit the paper, and then I join my people. So finally, time result, I think it's very interesting. It was done initially for bacteriorhodopsin, acetylcholine receptor. Joachim is working on rapid mixing apparatus, which I think is very interesting. So any news, Joachim?
Yes.
Why is it not so important anymore? I still like it. I really like it. But there are other ways to do it. You just collect humongous data sets and you do a lot of computational classification and you can get time resolution this way. Another way is you try in situ EM, but you keep the specimen in liquid and you put in the microscope. I have to say what the point is beyond me. But I don't really know, so maybe we can discuss this. I would really like to learn what the advantages from doing EM in a fluid state. And so this I'm going to skip. This is just a very long and painful story that we tried to get a specimen prepared. So we did a lot of stuff. So we all get questions. Most specimens are still not ready for atomic resolution. Couldn't agree more. Very true. What are the specific and general problems? The problems with the proteins. Proteins have different size, shape, symmetry, heterogeneity. So we have to try and figure this one out. What can be done about them? Optimize biochemistry, prepare optimal grids, collect perfect data, use the best image processing strategy, and then hope that you get high resolution. And that's something we really need to figure out. Why not everything goes to really high resolution? If the heterogeneity is limited, learn some interesting biology. It's not all bad. So maybe this is actually even more interesting than just to go to very high resolution. Which approaches have been tried in the past? How successful have they been? Which approaches look like the most promising? So EM data and image processing have dramatically improved. So this means also automation and computer power has improved dramatically. So now we can collect huge data sets. We can do a lot of classification. So what this means is that the resolution will become increasingly better for increasingly more difficult specimens. And I really believe that it's going to get more and more exciting. And sample homogeneity will actually become less critical as you can do more and more computation. But it will always make your life easier the more homogeneous the sample is. And in terms of biochemistry, obviously you can always try different homologues, especially extremophiles, optimize buffer cross-linking, blood-linking, I think are the most promising approaches like that. The last question is a very interesting one. Given that many small and heterogeneous samples may not only be suitable for examination negative stain, bad word,
high resolution, how do we make sure that the general scientific community and ours too understands that not everything is getting to atomic resolution? My answer is, beyond me, but I have limited imagination. So there's a guy who is really famous for his imagination, and so I went and looked up what he thought about these things. And so one quote I found was, two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the universe. Not very important. So I kept looking and I found something else, and I said, if you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. I think that's our problem. We don't really know at this moment why we can't go to a bit of high resolution information to all our specimens, and that's really something we should discuss. And that's it. And have fun. And I think we should have the questions in this discussion section.
I agree. Let's take a 30-minute break. And we'll be back here at 5:55.
That was fabulous. Even running over, it doesn't matter. But people talked.
Yeah, so
that was really good.
Yeah, so that was the point. So yeah. Hopefully so it continues.
Wildly successful.
Thank you.